I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Berlin at the climax of the Cold War, a priceless dossier, and an MI6 agent on a mission for Her Majesty's Secret Service. If those aren't the ingredients of a great action film, I don't know what is. Today, the indie, foreign, and documentary film critics return to review that plot and others. From a behind-the-scenes look at the making of a soundtrack to a survival horror in the outlands of Australia, even a raunchy comedy about potty-mouthed nuns, there's something showing now to please all palates. We'll also check out a local film that explores the dramatic increase in prescription drug prices. Our movie masters make their triumphant return on Up to Date after this hour's news. You've probably heard about it. Now we're going to talk about it. I'm talking about the new film Atomic Blonde, starring Charlize Theron, that's drawing so much attention as yet another example of a super-powered woman who's very much in charge. We'll talk about Atomic Blonde and a whole lot of other films today with our film critics. They are Cindy Haynes, the one-time film professor. Cindy, good to have you.
Thank you very much, Steve.
KCUR Steve Walker is here.
Hello,
Steven.
Thank you.
And Bob Butler, who reviews movies for the Kansas City Star. You can read his reviews at butlercinemascene.com. Robert, how are you?
Greetings all.
We're going to begin today with a look at a new documentary that takes a look at out-of-control drug prices. That film is Big Pharma Market Failure, and it screens at 10 tomorrow morning at the Faro Cinema 4 out in Independence, and the screening is free. Joining us now is Dr. Ed Weisbart, who served as a consultant on this film. He's a family physician from St. Louis and chair of Physicians for a National Health Program, Missouri chapter, that advocates for Medicare for All. And Dr. Weisbart, nice to have you.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Ed, just how out of control are drug prices in this country that you talk about in this new film?
Drug prices are profoundly out of control. They're one of the leading drivers of the escalating cost of health care in the country, and they're making it more and more difficult for employers to pay for health care.
You know, this film is titled Big Pharma Market Failure. How has the market failed here?
Well, we have the largest pharmaceutical market in the world, and yet our prices are also the highest in the world. And a free market, the larger your market, the lower the prices are supposed to be.
Okay. Who else has questions for Cindy Haynes? Yeah.
Ed, I'm wondering, to what effect does advertising have on the price of drugs?
Advertising is terrifically important. We are one of the only two countries, us and New Zealand, that permit direct-to-patient advertising. No place else permits that. And patients come in to see physicians specifically requesting the drug they saw on TV.
Hmm. And that mucks up the whole works, it sounds like.
It does, because I could spend 20 minutes with you explaining why a cheaper drug is just as good, and you'll leave dissatisfied. Or I could spend 30 seconds writing you the prescription, and you'll leave happy. And I'm paid the same, whichever way I go.
Steve Walker?
There's a word that kind of just lingers in my mouth like poison, and that's lobbyists, for various reasons. But in this film, what I was struck by was the revolving door between Congress and then congressmen who retire and become lobbyists for the pharma.
Yes,
big pharma.
And they often do their work in Congress to support big pharma, as Billy Towson did, and then once they've proven their value, then they move on to private industry. And it corrupts our political process.
Wasn't there a statistic that there are two lobbyists for every person in Congress?
The movie calls out that for the last, I think, 8 years, the pharmaceutical industry spent $450,000 per congressperson per year lobbying.
Wow. Wow.
There's no constraints.
Right.
On lobbying. That's the other thing that just makes me sick.
Right.
The movie, no pun intended.
No, right.
Yeah, it literally makes you sick. The movie walks through that. It walks through how it makes a great case for the micro issue of pharmaceuticals because there's great data about that, and it talks about lobbying and all that. But clearly the lessons are far broader than just pharmaceuticals, although that's what the movie focuses on.
Let me play the devil's advocate here. I watch this movie and I'm going, this is an overwhelming, damning case against the business as usual that we've got going on here. Then I said to myself, well, of course, you know, there are two sides to every story. So what if I had to make a documentary defending Big Pharma? What would possibly be my rationale? What could my argument be? And all I could come up with is, it's a free country and I can make as much money as I want. If it kills people, tough. That's the only rationale I can come up with.
Good morning, Mr. Shkreli. Yeah.
Well, honestly, I don't think this is a story of good versus evil. I think this is a story of private industry making a profit within the market constraints that we permit them to. And I think the issue is not that pharma is evil. That's not my position at all. I think the issue is that we've allowed our democracy to be taken over by their financial interests. If we fix that and then constrain how the free market operates, but still encourage the free market, I think we can make a big win out of this.
The film makes a big case for negotiating drug prices, something that just doesn't happen here. What would it take to make that happen?
It would take a minor change in the law. I mean, it just takes passing a law that permits that. Today, the law that created Medicare Part D specifically said that the federal government cannot negotiate the prices of drugs, and so we should change that.
And that was a big issue when it passed, right? And the Democrats lost that on that issue, if I understand correctly.
Correct. So we have to persuade Congress to revisit that issue.
Okay. What do you want to see happen here, Ed? What else needs to happen?
Well, within the pharmaceutical industry, which is what we're talking about, we need to have an impact on patents. It's ridiculous to give 20-year new patents to drugs that are so similar to the current drugs, but no evidence that they're any better, that then they can market these drugs. We can't cut off marketing. I'm not saying that. There's a First Amendment right to that. But if we established a national formulary that had the better drugs on it, then there wouldn't be a business case for doing all of this advertising. So I want to see a single national formulary that Medicare develops, that Medicare negotiates prices for, and that those prices become available to all Americans.
Okay. I expect that the movie's 40 minutes long, but you're going to have a Q&A tomorrow after the screening. I imagine that will be pretty lively. Have you done Q&As in other cities and seen what can viewers expect tomorrow morning?
So the movie is new. It was released in the end of April, but I've had, I'm going to guess, a dozen events like this around the state of Missouri,
okay,
and usually with a discussion afterwards. And frankly, it's pretty hard not to just come to the conclusion that we have to fix this. But there is always the question about, you know, how do we support an industry that brings life-saving drugs to us? So we'll have that discussion.
Sure.
Okay, I want to thank Dr. Ed Weisbar for coming in. Again, the film he's talking about is Big Pharma Market Failure. It screens at 10 tomorrow morning at the Faro Cinema 4 out in Independence. And Dr. Weisbar, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Okay, let's go on with our other films here. And let's talk just for a moment about Big Pharma Market Failure. Cindy, yeah, go ahead.
I'm very impressed with the technical quality of this documentary. Usually you have someone people who are not filmmakers necessarily come in and wind up creating what I often consider propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
And so I asked someone who had been involved with a hospital in the Topeka area, asked him to watch the film, and he felt it absolutely told the truth, that this was not a film that exaggerates or goes beyond the bounds of telling the truth.
Mm-hmm.
About this very, very important issue.
Bob Butler, what'd you think?
Made me mad.
Yeah, yeah.
Made me very angry.
Which is sort of the idea here.
Yeah,
I think it is.
But
yeah.
You know, it's when you we're kind of inured anymore to this sort of thing. We've seen so much. You know, got a tough skin, but man, this got me angry.
Okay.
Yeah, it's very well made. There's very little talking. There are very few talking heads in
it,
too.
And there seem to be very credible doctors and politicians involved in this discussion. That's part of the documentary.
And you can see my notes here, Steve. This is the same amount of notes I take for a 2.5-hour film. And this is 40 minutes of notes of things I just went, what? Really? Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
So it's one of those kind of films.
The film, again, is titled Big Pharma Market Failure. It screens at 10 Saturday morning at the Faro Cinema 4 out in Independence. It's free as well. Okay, let's move on to the film that has a lot of people talking. It's titled Atomic Blonde. It's an ultra-violent spy film about a female British agent running around in Berlin at the end of the Cold War, based on the graphic novel The Coldest City, by Anthony Johnston and Sam Hart. This is the Charlize Theron film. Bob, tell us about it.
I cannot recall another movie in recent times that has so effectively fetishized and drooled over its leading lady. Huh. She marches in here with white hair and a white trench coat. She kicks booty like nobody's business. I mean, it's like she doesn't have superpowers per se, but wow. She gets beat up, and she's beautiful even through all the, you know, bruise makeup. The movie itself was directed by a guy named David Leitch, who, it's his first feature. Up to now, he's been a stuntman. He directed the fight scenes in the John Wick movie, the action scenes, which were terrific, I have to admit. And not surprisingly, the film is least effective when it's talk, 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 because we've got a lot of people throwing around foreign names, and you're going, well, who's that guy? What? I don't understand.
And it's very confusing.
Very confusing plot, yes. But two-thirds of the way through, there is an extended, maybe 15-minute action fight scene that is just stupendous, and that hooked me right there. Right.
I look forward to seeing the film. I thought it was going to be a lot of fun, and at times it really is. Charlize Theron has been on talk shows, you know, for the past several weeks.
She produced it.
One of the producers, about the fact that she did her own stunts, that those bruises were hers, that in fact, you know, she spent training for months to play a believable character like that. And unfortunately, 90% of the time, this white wig that she has obscures her face. And you want to say, if you're going to such extremes to make this a realistic, well, you can't, that's not the right word, but make a movie like this, you want to see that your lead actress is the one who's actually doing the kicking.
Did you like it?
What I liked about it was the 80s music. If it hadn't a soundtrack that was so entertaining, I think I would have been terribly disappointed in the film.
There are a couple of smart references to Hitchcock films in this. One is she's looking for something called, quote unquote, the list. It's a list of Allied spies that this German security guy has in his head. That's the MacGuffin. That's the thing that everybody wants to get their hands on, the good guys, the bad guys. There is a scene late in the film where she's trying to get this German security guy out of the country. She's going through a street demonstration, people all around her. And at a given moment, just when the Stasi snipers are ready to blow them away, someone gives a signal and everybody in the crowd opens an umbrella to hide them. That was right out of the Foreign Correspondent by Hitchcock back in like 1937. So there are some clever references here. But again, it's mostly the good stuff is the fighting stuff.
So did you like it, Bob?
I liked it, but not enough to say you got to go see it.
Okay.
You know, believe me, when it's on cable, I'll be all over it again. But
you know, people are making a big deal about Charlize Theron being, you know, the new queen of the action movie. We have Uma Thurman, Lucy Liu, Angelina Jolie, Sigourney Weaver, Scarlett Johansson, Michelle Rodriguez, Pam Grier. I could just go on and on and on. And it's nothing new. I mean,
well, what should we make of the fact this is the second sort of movie starring a woman in recent months? That the woman is the empowered star
Wonder
action
woman.
Figure
You're
here.
About Wonder,
Wonder woman.
Woman
being the other one. What do I make of this? Anything or not? Because given the history here, you just cited a lot of it.
I didn't,
it goes back a ways.
I didn't see Atomic Blonde, but one of my favorite movies is Charlize is in Mad Max Fury Road, where she also kicked an amazing
Furiosa.
Amount
yeah.
of tush. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Tough. She's a tough broad.
She plays it well.
In the best sense. And, yeah.
So she's fun to watch.
She's
but
very
you,
fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But in terms of the sociological impact here,
you know,
am I reaching too far here?
No, it's more of the same. I mean, that's an advertising ploy is what that is. You don't have to look that far to find women that punch hard in the movies anymore.
And you know she's a good actress. I mean, would you win an Oscar
for Monster? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Our listeners may be saying, why are you guys even talking about it? And that's because it's a Focus Features release, which is their indie branch. And so we debated before the show earlier this week, do we review it or not? And if it's Focus Features, we've done all their other films on this show.
Okay. That's Atomic Blonde, sort of Midland reviews for that film from our two reviewers here. Let's move on to a film, A Ghost Story, Bob Butler. It's a film about love and loss featuring a deceased ghost who wears a white sheet and returns to his suburban home to reconnect with his grieving wife.
It sounds like a dumb idea. It ended up being one of the more profound movie-going experiences of recent months. Rooney Mara and Oscar-winning Casey Affleck play a couple living in a sort of a, you know, semi-decrepit tract home. They're a happy couple. Early in the film, he's killed in a traffic accident. She goes to the morgue, identified his body. They throw a sheet over his face, and the camera just sits there looking at this form on the table, and suddenly it sits up and starts walking away, looking like nothing so much as a five-year-old kid in a bedsheet ghost costume. And that is basically what you're going to be in for the next 70 or so minutes. The ghost walks home, observes his girlfriend, wife, hangs around even after she leaves, goes through a series of tenants. Even when the house is torn down, he's stuck. We are told that it is Casey Affleck under the sheet, but I got to tell you, this is one of the great physical performances.
Oh, my gosh. My theory is, I mean, Casey's under a sheet. When the ghost, and this is about the writing too, Bob, which was very good. When the ghost was feeling forlorn, that we could only see the two eye holes, you felt it. When the ghost was feeling happy about something, you felt it.
And it isn't talking. It's a silent movie, practically.
And it's just, yes, it's like, I don't know what it was, body movement. I think my other theory, though, is Casey Affleck was so powerful in Manchester by the Sea last year, where he was a very sad, forlorn man. And that performance lingers a lot with people
that may be true.
Who appreciated it and so understand this is the sad, forlorn Casey Affleck we've come to know.
Right, Cindy.
Why was it considered one of the more divisive films at Sundance this year? This kind of loved it or hated it?
I think some people, Bob, there's a yin and a yang.
Yeah, some people laughed at it. He says, look at this guy walking around a bedsheet. I'm supposed to watch a bedsheet for the next hour? But I found it to be a real profound meditation on love and loss and yearning.
And sense of place, because you mentioned it goes to the next owners of the house and then to the next ones. And then I don't know how many years in the future when there's a huge high-rise built there, the ghost is still there. And then there's a sequence.
Set in the 1900s.
At least like the
1800s.
Covered wagon comes upon the same place. So it's about, in this director's idea, the ghosts haunt people, yes, but people who are in places that were meaningful. Does that make sense?
Yeah. The director is David Lowery, who, believe it or not, his last movie was Disney's Pete's Dragon. So this guy's got some range here. This is by far the best thing he's ever done.
Want to mention it's opening today at Screenland, Tivoli, the Glenwood Arts and Liberty Hall and in Lawrence and Cinemark.
Bob, we got a clip here.
Yeah, we do.
Film.
This is they don't have many scenes together, just at the very beginning and the very end. This is the young couple, Rooney Mara and Casey Affleck, before tragedy befalls them.
This is not how it's supposed to work. We're supposed to make decisions together. Can you understand that?
Yes.
So why am I the only one making them?
Because I don't want what you want.
Because you want to stay here?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
That's from a ghost story.
Very interesting. If you're expecting a big, scary Nightmare on Elm Street kind of thing, this is not it.
No, this is the exact opposite, in fact.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. Okay, that two thumbs up for a ghost story here. Let's grab one more before a break here, Cindy Haynes. Let's go to a film titled Killing Ground. It's your worst campaign nightmare featuring an abandoned toddler. Your worst camping nightmare featuring an abandoned toddler, three women, two men, and two off-the-charts sociopaths. And wild pigs. Help me. Jeez.
Well, that's what I said halfway through watching this film. It's incredibly violent, incredibly brutal. It's Australian. It should have had subtitles. I get so frustrated when I see films like this, and of course we have to have a rape scene. Rape is not entertainment, and there are some very brutal scenes here. A young toddler is injured. It's just, I don't understand why people make films like this and the fact that there's an audience out there for them. Technically, it's well made. It cuts back and forth between the stories of these two families who wind up getting slaughtered. I can't recommend it. And this is a personal opinion of mine about the matters of violence against women in films like this.
How do you really feel? Yeah.
I will agree with her that it's unpalatable. It's well made, unpalatable.
Yeah.
That's the end of my comment.
In a nutshell, that's okay. It. It's like you'll find yourself squirming and admiring the smarts with which it was made while hating the subject matter.
Right.
Well, despite all this, we have a clip from this film. Again, it's titled Killing Ground, and a film that no one's going to go see now. But what is the film, Cindy?
So we have the nubile teenage daughter sitting in the automobile as one of the sociopaths approaches.
Okay.
Hello.
What are you doing?
Did I scare you?
Where's Mom and Dad?
Don't know.
What are you doing?
Nothing. Just relax, okay?
Just get away from the car.
I'm not gonna hurt you.
Just get away.
Why don't you come out? Come on.
Okay, that film is Killing Ground, and you have been forewarned. Do not go see it. Okay, too violent, and maybe that's enough said for Killing Ground. Okay, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation and talk about some films that even I've seen, including The Big Sick, Maudie, and something else I think I've seen as well. The Little Hours. Okay, I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's show, we discussed President Trump's nomination of Kansas Governor Sam Brownback for an International Religious Freedom Ambassadorship. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. On Monday, we bring you a mayoral debate from Kansas City, Kansas, hosted this week by KCUR and Donnelly College. We'll meet the five candidates to get you ready for elections coming up on August 1st. That's Monday on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, this hour, as Linda said, we're visiting with our film critics, Cindy Haynes, Steve Walker, and Bob Butler. And here's a film, Cindy, that has me interested. It's titled Score, a film music documentary. It's an excellent documentary about the art of composing music for films, featuring dozens of interviews with elite composers.
Here, I really would like every person who's ever gone to a movie to see this documentary. Truly, after you watch it, you will not see or hear movies in the same
really?
Way again.
Yeah.
It is absolutely wonderful. I've seen a lot of documentaries about film music and composers, and it's just talking heads, and it's kind of tedious. This guy, Matt Schrader, directed the film and got Quincy Jones, James Cameron, Danny Elfman, Trent Reznor, Hans Zimmer to talk about the creative process and making films. Hmm. And it's just so well put together. Usually such films feature the grandmasters like Bernard Herrmann and John Williams, but he has some contemporary filmmakers in here, including Hans Zimmer, who did the music for Dunkirk.
The amazing score for Dunkirk.
But this works, you're saying, because what, it dives more deeply into the creative process than typically these films do?
Exactly. And they're not canned responses from these composers. I mean, they really are trying to explain what it is that inspires them, how they do what they do. And you'll just walk out with so much insight. I loved it. It's at Screenland. And I really, really recommend it.
But it also gives great examples from over the years. Way too many from the last 20 years for my tastes. I liked better the scenes of the old films, like the old Hitchcock with Bernard mm-hmm. Herrmann and that kind of stuff. But the interesting point it makes was music's effect on the brain. And these composers are aware of that and talk about how certain scores and certain ways violins are played affect dopamine. That was really interesting. And another interesting point, one composer said, even in different cities, different orchestras emit different sounds. Like the Chicago Symphony would sound, see the score and do it one way, and then the Philadelphia another way. I mean, I thought that was just really, really interesting.
That's interesting. We have a clip here from the film Score, a film music documentary. Cindy, what is it?
And this is Hans Zimmer talking about composing.
I'm very fragile when I have to play a piece of music to anybody. I can listen. Right now, we can chat for hours, and in a funny way, I'm very secure about this. Because I hide behind the words. You'll never really figure me out. But I think when I play you a piece of music, I completely expose myself, and that's a really scary moment. The way I work is very much like keeping a diary. I come in every day and just move forward. I don't actually listen to what I did yesterday. Very rarely do I, but I don't change it. So I write these suites, which are very much my way of getting into the movie, my way of describing the movie, and really all the material usually is drawn from that.
Well, that's a film that a lot of folks might overlook, but Cindy, you just sold me on it. Again, the film is titled Score, a Family Music Documentary, and one more film that gets two big thumbs up here, right?
Yes.
Okay. Let's scoot on here to a film titled The Little Hours, Bob Butler. It's set in the 14th century. It's a screwball farce featuring a servant who flees after he's caught sleeping with his master's wife. Pretending to be a deaf mute, he takes refuge in a convent populated by three emotionally unstable, neurotic nuns.
You know, if you're gonna steal, okay, steal from the best. And writer-director Jeff Baena, in this case, borrowed heavily. He adapted Boccaccio's Decameron. Boccaccio specialized in bawdy, naughty stories of, well, I'm surprised he got away with it, frankly, given the period in which he was writing. So you've got this very farcical setup. You'll know you're in weird country almost immediately because the look of the film is absolutely history authentic. The props, the costumes, the castles, the convent. And then people open their mouths and the nuns talk like valley girls and people swear using modern language and idioms. And that contrast is what gives this thing its comic oomph. In fact, it comes perilously close to being a one-joke idea.
Unfortunately.
It does, but I want to read some of the cast because all of you will have some connection to some of these people, a very fond connection. Molly Shannon, Paul Reiser, Alison Brie, Nick Offerman, Dave Franco, Aubrey Plaza, John C. Reilly, Fred Armisen. That's just a few of them.
Yeah, it's an amazing cast. And in fact, every time someone new walks on, you go, oh, you sort of slap your forehead and go, wait a minute, will the wonders never cease? There is some really, really funny stuff in here. I just felt that it couldn't maintain it for the whole run of the film.
I thought Monty Python right off the bat as I'm watching this. Another film came to mind, Cold Comfort Farm,
right,
which was much funnier, much more clever, told a somewhat similar story. And I agree with you, Bob. It's kind of a one note over and over and over again. And it's just, you know, what sort of foul-mouthed insult can, you know.
Yeah, now I have to admit that I love the idea of Aubrey Plaza as the most bad-tempered nun in all of recorded history.
And the nuns have a kind of a pack mentality.
Yes.
I mean, if you cross one, you've crossed all of them.
Well, maybe think Beguiled with...
Maybe. Yeah, maybe.
Anyway, we've got a clip here, and this is Dave Franco. Well, actually, he's present, but since he's pretending to be a deaf mute, I don't think he says anything. But Molly Shannon is the Mother Superior. I believe we've got Audrey Plaza. We may have Alison Brie as one of
Molly
the nuns.
Molly Shannon is the Mother Superior?
Yes.
There you go.
Did I mention she's having an affair with the priest played by John C. Reilly? This is Boccaccio, after all. People are very, very horny. Okay, so go ahead and let her rip with the clip.
Did he just smile at you?
I don't know.
Why is he smiling? Who is that?
Who the f*** are you? Who are you? Who are you?
Fernanda, stop! He's an intruder. I don't know who the f*** he is.
Let me get Mother Maria.
Fine, go. Tell me who you are. What? Say something. Where did you come from? What is that? What are you doing with your hands? What? What, are you hungry? What is that, a bird? You're praying?
The f*** are you saying to me?
Father Tommaso hired him. I'm sorry I didn't tell you about it.
That's from The Little Hours.
And even without the visuals, that's funny. I mean, I'm sitting here laughing when we're listening to the clip.
Well, it's the incongruity of the, you know, the nun's habit and the raunchy language that tears me up.
It's a valiant effort. Let's put it that way.
You know, and Cindy Haynes, as a reviewer who goes to a film like this, it sounds like the one joke that sort of propels this thing work for you for a little bit, but then not a whole lot longer. Do you sit through the whole thing?
Absolutely, yeah.
You hung in there?
Yes, I always do.
Were you going crazy by the end?
Yes, and on occasion, you know, the final minutes of a film will redeem it. So,
you know, I have found that when I'm driving to the theater to see a movie I'm really not eager for, and I pass a guy digging a ditch on a 100-degree day, that I can tough it out.
You can. Yeah.
Cynthia was also struck by how much handsomer Dave Franco is than his brother James. I just thought that was interesting.
Anyway,
that she pointed
very
that
true.
Out this morning.
Yeah. Very true.
Okay, that film is The Little Hours, and mixed reviews at best for that one. If I'm hearing,
no, it was on my 3 to see last week. I enjoyed it.
Oh, okay.
Quite a bit.
Okay. There you go. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking this morning about the latest art, independent, and foreign films now showing. We're visiting with Steve Walker, Cindy Haynes, and Bob Butler here. And if our listeners want to chime in with questions or comments, you're welcome to do so. 816-235-2888 is the number. You can also tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Let's move on to a film that's turning out to be something of the sleeper hit of the summer, at least in the art and independent film world. This film is titled Maudie, and it's based on the lives of two damaged souls. It's a story of Maddie and Everett Lewis, who live in Nova Scotia. That's a true story it's based on. This is sort of a reprise of their lives here. Steve Walker, tell us about Maudie.
Well, Maudie Lewis was, by the time she passed away, a very famous folk artist.
So, the Grandma Moses of Canada.
Exactly, and so much so that the home that she spends much of the film painting, with the walls and the shelves, and is still preserved in Halifax, like a museum piece. Sally Hawkins, who people may know best from her Oscar-nominated turn as Kate Blanchett's sister in Blue Jasmine, does a phenomenal job playing this woman. She's stricken by crippling arthritis, very quiet, very shy, lives with a demanding mother who's not very nice to her. She sees an ad for a house cleaner, and she takes it off the little grocery store bulletin board, shows up at the home of, who else? Ethan Hawke, who plays kind of, he's illiterate, I believe, his character. He's a handyman, raises livestock. She starts to work for him, and they develop a relationship that's not ideal, let's say. But you really get the sense, as I said in my 3 to see blurb, it's unconventionally romantic movie.
Very.
And he's very good, too.
Here's the, go ahead.
Well, I think Sally Hawkins is incredible in this film. I mean, she embodies Maudie.
Mm-hmm.
Ethan Hawke, I felt, was totally miscast in the role.
Oh, really?
I really did.
He came in late. Someone else was in that role, actually.
Well, yeah. and I could...
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I can't remember who. But yeah. I'm not going to say, because I thought
but
it was
But I do
fine.
Think it was a mistake, because he never got out of being Ethan Hawke. I never felt like he really became Everett Lewis in this film.
You know, here's an issue. Everett, he is a primitive. If he doesn't like what his housekeeper, soon-to-be wife, says, he uses the back of his hand to enforce his brute will. This is a kind of character that in most movies would be written off immediately as a total human loss. Mm-hmm. We don't want anything to do with him. I think it's because he's Ethan Hawke and we have certain positive, you know, vibes from him in his previous performances, that we give this guy a chance to develop into the surprisingly loving and supporting person he becomes by the end of their lives. Begins in the 1930s, ends, I think, in the 70s. And it's a story of a relationship that most of us would find far from ideal, but which for these two crushed characters...
Right. You're right.
Is vitally important.
Correct me if I'm wrong. The film was shot up in Nova Scotia,
yes.
I want to say. And, and the shots of the land and the setting here, I thought, were just breathtaking.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a certain quirkiness about this film. I'm not quite sure how to say it beyond that I thought worked pretty well, too.
Do you think it needed subtitles?
No, but I understand why you're going there.
Yeah, for me, there were times when I, you know, even I'd miss a word or a sentence, and it would just sort of throw me off.
You know, you mentioned Sally Hawkins' performance. What I loved about her is that even while she's this poor browbeaten, you know, not even a young woman, she's in her 30s when this starts, there is a spark of defiance in her.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And in fact, because she moves in this shuffle and her hands are swollen and she moves, people think that she must be mentally challenged as well as physically. And actually, she's got a really sharp brain.
Yeah, and she gives it as good as she gets.
And I think she takes a look at Everett and she says, maybe I can do something with this guy.
Mm-hmm. And speaking to her dignity, too, she's some kids say to her, you walk funny. Are you sick? And she goes, no, I was born funny.
Yeah.
So she's heard it all before, but that doesn't let her get her
Steve,
down.
Steve, what do you think about Ethan Hawke in that role?
Well, I think it's a really interesting point. It hadn't occurred to me. I got through it okay without getting waylaid by that idea. I found the older I get bored more easily. This film took me the whole way through. I was caught up in it and enjoyed it. I enjoyed the music. I enjoyed the landscapes. I was a little bothered by the scene where Ethan Hawke gives her the back of his hand and how she rallied from that moment going forward. That took me a while. That moment was so...
To shake that off, yeah.
So upsetting. It was a little hard for me to move on from it.
It's kind of essential, though, to the theme of the whole movie.
Well, it is. You sort of get why it happened. What's the clip we have here?
We have a clip where she has found the note looking for a housekeeper at the store, and she shows up at his front door of his little hovel.
And we're talking a one-room, like,
right.
10 by 10
yes.
hovel.
Little house.
From Maudie.
Oh, I'm Maud. Dowie.
Dowie?
Yeah, that's right. Got your ad at the store. The one you posted looking for a housemaid.
Yeah.
Well, I'm answering it.
What? Looking for a woman.
Well, what do you think I am?
You know, again, going back to her character, you know, there's a sense you get in the film that she has got to make this work. This is her shot.
That's a great point.
At her own independence, mm-hmm. her own life. And that worked for me pretty well, too. It came through so clearly what I thought was an outstanding performance. We're going to see Sally Hawkins' name come award season.
Oscar time, I think she might be a real
contender. There's no question about that. Yeah.
And the point you make is really good because she leaves this house that her mother has verbally abused her, emotionally
abused.
Actually,
her aunt.
Her aunt. And she, like you said, Steve, she packs up her bag and her aunt's like, where are you going? She goes, I'm gone. I've got a job. And she's mm-hmm. like, oh, you will be a utter failure at it.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, well, let me show you that I may not be.
She's got to make this work. And that was fascinating.
There was something there. There's a point at which her folk art is starting to take off.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a point at which her husband, Everett, looks like he might step on it and stop it. And she does something brilliant. She has both of them sign the artwork. It's a family enterprise. And with both their names on it, he can't very well blow it off now because he's getting some of the credit for it.
And she's just bringing money in because she's selling little postcards.
Smart lady.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, a lot of high recommendations for Maudie, which opens up at Liberty Hall, the Fine Arts Theater, and the Tivoli this week, right?
Yes.
Okay. Again, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, we're talking about some good new films that are out on area theaters right now. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Okay, Steve Walker, let's move on to a film that also has some buzz attached to it. It's called The Big Sick. It's a romantic comedy based on the actual relationship between a Pakistani-American stand-up comedian and his American girlfriend. And this is a true story.
True story.
As true as you can get.
Yeah, it is. The Pakistani comedian is played by the Pakistani comedian Kumail Nanjiani, who many people may know from Silicon Valley on HBO. He was a big part of Portlandia in the early days. Very funny man. And he and his wife, Emily Gordon, wrote this that talks about their story. And their story is they met at a comedy club. She is Caucasian. He is Pakistani. And his family is very in the old style, traditional, trying to set him up with a young woman from Pakistan. They meet, fall in love. They break up. And again, we don't want to give too many spoilers, but she gets sick. The big sick of the title is her becoming so ill that she's put in an induced coma, and Kumail doesn't go anywhere. Even though they've broken up, he sticks around.
He hangs in there, he meets
her parents, really nicely played by Ray Romano and Holly Hunter.
Really nicely played.
Holly Hunter, yes. I think, will be nominated as well for supporting. She's terrific in this movie. And they actually form a bond, and then she's not sick anymore. And that's, I think, all we want to really say.
I think it's so difficult to find that balance between comedy and pathos here. And I do want to mention the Muslim immigrant parents, too, the roles that they played in this. I think it was handled very well. Zenobia Shroff and Anupam Kher. And it shows the challenges that a mixed couple
This notion that the film was walking this line between drama and comedy, how well did they pull it off then, in your view?
I think it was pulled up very well, and I think it's because of Kumail's acting talent.
Now, he's really playing who he was in real life.
Right.
But the female actress is
Zoe Kazan.
But she's not his real life.
No.
Yeah,
okay.
She's an actress, New York-based, the granddaughter of the great director Ilya Kazan. In fact,
she's
very good at it too. She's very sweet.
I think it's curious that there's so many films coming out these days about stand-up comics. This Don't Think Twice, written by Mike Birbiglia, and Folk Hero and Funny Guy, also another focusing on what's with that, Bob?
It's a good. Well, you know, show business loves to navel gaze, and
that's such a hard job. It's an inherently fascinating one because it's so hard.
Have you ever thought about going out and bombing?
My son's tried it and had some success.
Well, my daughter's
watching
done it.
Him.
Yeah,
well,
so,
your daughter, of course. Yeah.
There is a moment in this film that I really love. He's at home, and it's 4 in the afternoon, and he says his mother sends him down to the basement to pray. He's a good Muslim. You got to do it, right? Yeah. And the camera, using a speeded up fast forward, shows him down in the basement doing everything but praying. He's going through boxes. He's looking at his childhood toys. And it tells you all you need to know about this kid who comes from one culture and has pretty much blown it off to be part of another culture.
And the subtlety and the beauty of Kumail's performance is that he doesn't dismiss it. He doesn't trash it.
But he wants to honor
his parents.
He just can't.
He loves his parents so much, but he's just in his one part of his brain, I'm in 2017, I love this girl.
Mm-hmm.
Who happens to be white.
End of story. Yeah.
Well,
how he felt about her.
Right.
We have a clip here, Steve Walker, from The Big Sick.
It's a clip of Kumail and Ray Romano and Holly Hunter have gone back to their apartment because they're in town visiting their sick daughter, and they're just kind of being silly and goofy.
Here's a joke.
No. Terry don't. Terry's about as funny as a fart at a funeral.
No. This is funny. This is a funny one. A giraffe walks into a bar, and he says to the bartender, "Highball's on me." You get it, right?
Oh, that was the end of the joke?
Yeah, of course.
That was the whole joke.
That's the joke. That's the beauty of it. Boom.
I thought there was more.
But you get it. He's a giraffe. He's tall. So it would stand to reason his testicles are high, and a highball is a drink. And you ruined it by saying I wasn't funny first. That's what it was.
You know, Ray Romano was great. And the integration between Kumail going and becoming friendly with the girl's parents, that had to work. And it did work, I thought.
It had to work, but it doesn't for a while. And Holly Hunter is like stone cold. You are not part of this family.
But the kid gets there. And that's the beauty.
Well, he does.
Well,
there's a wonderful scene where she follows him to a comedy gig. And when he is being harassed by some college boy idiot, she goes ballistic.
That's a great scene.
It's a tremendous Holly Hunter moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right. Movie. She'll be up for something here. Yeah. Well, we just have a couple minutes left here, and this is a really good time of year. We're just over the halfway point of 2017. Maybe time to stop and pause and look back at some of the best films so far this year, at least from the vantage points of our very good critics here. We have a list here in front of us, and it might help if we just give a sentence or two to remind people what these different films were about. Cindy, do you want to take the lead here?
Well, the list includes a lot of foreign films. I think those are the ones, the memorable ones over the past 6 months. But Franz is a war story, a romantic story set in Germany, right?
In World War One, yes.
World War One. Graduation, another foreign film about the efforts that a father goes to get his daughter into college. I Don't Feel at Home Anymore, Steve. You turned me on to that.
I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore is one of my favorite films of the year. It's currently still on Netflix.
Land of Mine, about young German soldiers who are forced to remove landmines from the beaches. Oh, gosh.
I think that's on Netflix as well. And
I believe it is.
Yeah.
Suzanne et moi, Jeremy Tower, a documentary that was excellent about the life of a chef. Megan Levy, about a young woman in the military. Very well told. The Exception, which is currently showing in theaters with Christopher Plummer.
Boy, that's a good film. And you all had it on your three to see, which is where I went to go look for a film to go see a couple weekends ago. And I went because you guys recommended it.
And you liked
it. Really liked it.
I Am Not Your Negro, another documentary.
That is one of the greatest documentaries about race in America ever made.
It is.
That's a James Baldwin film we talked about.
Right.
Yeah.
And I, Daniel Blake.
Wow.
Which is,
Ken Loach, what is he, 82, 83 years old, a British director who every year cranks out a masterpiece. How does he do it?
It's a fantastic film. Yeah.
And also Get Out, right?
What does it say about the fact that horror genre has produced this year Get Out and Ghost Story, two things that, like, revive these old, tired cliches? It's wonderful.
And you have Maudie on the list too. Is that on the list?
Well, actually, two of the movies that have been sticking around the longest in local theaters, Maudie and Hero.
Okay, we just have a few seconds left. If you were going to go see just one film this weekend, or you can go for three, you're three to see. We'll put it up on KCUR's website later on today. It's where I go every weekend to find out what's going on.
My three choices are so different. But A Ghost Story would be one. The Big Sick is staying around on my list, as is Maudie.
Okay.
Score, a film music documentary. Big Pharma, really make an effort to go see that very interesting documentary. And The Exception, the Christopher Plummer.
And I'm with Steve. Ghost, Maudie, Big Sick.
Okay. I want to thank Steve Walker, Cindy Haynes, Bob Butler for a good conversation today. You can find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date, and you can follow me at Steve Kraske. On Monday's show, we'll meet the crowded field of candidates running for mayor over in Wyandotte County. The great Bobby Watson composed our theme music. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Marlia Campbell. Have a great weekend, all. Enjoy a movie. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.